August 3rd, 2020, and time for another edition of No Filter Sports. Got a lot to talk about today, but that's a cliche. There's always a lot to talk about. We got a great guest coming up today. Very timely guest in Jim Brandstetter. We'll talk about him in a moment. And, of course, the whole Bo thing is exploding. And Brandy will talk about that and college football, what the chances are.
Yeah. You know, when I called Brandy to set him up on the show over a week ago, I thought, we're just the three of us have known him for 100 years. We're just going to get on the show and laugh. And then all this stuff, Ken, this is going to be a lot more serious show, I fear, than I had hoped it would be.
Well, we got to try and do both, because with Brandy, it's always a lot of hilarious stories and jokes, and we go back.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely.
Let's Bob goes back to the very early days of your career. However, I don't know if you knew this or not, Denny, Jim and I were both freshmen at Michigan, and we took the exact same curriculum for 4 years.
Basket weaving
and kinesiology. No,
my Lord, are you old?
and by the way, we'll bring it up later with Jim. I was the first man to hire Jim Brandstetter to do U of M football. That is a true story that we will bring out later when we get into him. Oh, God. Meanwhile, I mean, you got to help me with the Tigers here, guys. A seven-inning doubleheader. I mean, you know, it's a complete
game. What's up with
game.
That? Oh, what's up with God. That?
The first game they lose to Cincinnati, and the reliever, you know, who's put the saves, pumps his fist in there in the seventh inning. I'm thinking, do you have no shame? You know what they should do? Start the game in the third inning then, so at least it looks like the ninth inning. You can't end a baseball game in the seventh inning if it isn't high school.
Well, you know what they're saying, Eli? I saw a blurb from Ken Rosenthal over the weekend on Twitter. He said they're trying to save pitching. In a 60-game season with expanded rosters, you're trying to save pitching?
Oh, God.
First of all, this kid strikes out 9 in a row yesterday. Terrific. I don't think he threw one bad pitch. Yeah, Alexander. I mean, he had a great fastball. He had a great slider. And he had a pretty good curveball. And then what really always gets me is somebody says, well, look at that backup slider. Gentlemen, nobody in the world throws a backup slider. When the ball backs up, it means they made a mistake and the ball is going to go the other way. It slipped out of the hand too soon, or they let it go too soon. This backup slider, all of a sudden, we've got new magic for the last.
Do you really believe that? I mean, I'm sure you guys didn't throw
that better. I know better.
Okay.
The ball comes out either early or late, and that's what happens. The ball will back up.
It spins the wrong way, right?
You're saying no pitcher in the big leagues throws that deliberately?
What's that?
You're saying no pitcher in the big leagues throws a backup slider deliberately?
There is no such thing.
Okay. Isn't it otherwise known as a screwball? It's a screwball.
Well, it doesn't break that much.
If you took about 80 miles an hour off of it, you know, I mean, I saw Harvey Haddix's pitch once in Wrigley Field in Chicago. He had a real screwball. I mean, that thing just disappeared.
And we all saw Willie Hernandez.
Yes.
It was a left-handed pitcher, and the ball went two and a half feet outside the right-handed side of the plate.
By the way, of course, without 40,000 people in the stands yesterday, Matt Shepard had to, for the ninth strikeout, put all the fans behind him and his voice. So here's what Tyler Alexander's ninth strikeout sounded like yesterday.
I'm throw him a breaking ball down in there.
2-2.
Yep.
Struck him out. The record goes to Tyler Alexander. It matches his career best. And since 1974, no reliever has ever done what he just did.
And I got to tell you,
what's up with that? Since 1974, I'm watching the game and I'm thinking, what the hell does that mean since 1974?
That's the last time somebody struck out as many as that. I understand.
But then they were talking later on about it's an all-time American League record. Then they said it was an all-time.
It's an all-time American League record, the National League record, and the all-time record for baseball was Tom Seaver when he struck out 10 in a row.
Thank you for settling that.
And several others have struck out 9. I don't know if it's ever been done in relief, though. Doug Pfister struck out 9, and he was a starter.
I was there that night, yeah. Huh.
So
I got to be a starting pitcher because of striking out 7 guys in a row. When I struck out 7 in a row against the Boston Red Sox, our manager, Dressen, came over and said, from now on, you're pitching in the fourth slot on this ball club. If you can do that once, you can do it twice. And Charlie was that kind of a guy.
Hey, I want to ask you this, Denny, since we mentioned it a moment ago. I've always read that a screwball is just hell on your elbow. Did you ever try to throw one?
I've tried everything. I mean, there isn't a pitch that all of us don't, especially if you got a guy in your club that can really have a good one. You try to go to him and you try to learn something that's a little bit better than what you have. And I tried. I couldn't get the thing to move to the left. I could move the ball with my fastball left and right, and obviously with a slider and a curveball. But I could never pick up something like that, the screwball. It was a tremendous strain, not only on the elbow, but on the shoulder also, because you're underneath that ball. What you got to believe is that you got to get on top of your shoulder in order to throw that screwball to make it go to the left.
So for you, it would have been right. Your normal breaking ball goes right to left from a right-hander. Right. It goes away from, and this would be require you to go left to right.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Eli, I was going to say, I'm glad you brought up. I love to hear these Matt Shepard cuts. Of course, I watch the games anyway. But I got a Matt Shepard cut for you that I'm going to do myself. And this would be from a year ago with Nick Castellanos at the plate. The 1-0 hits one to deep left center field. He pounded that baseball over the wall for a two-run shot. Now, those were the exact words that Matt spoke on Sunday when Nick did hit a two. The exact same words. But this time was... You know, he pounded that baseball over the for a two-run shot. This is pretty good theater with this guy and Jack Morris. And then on Friday night, and Matt says, you know, the Cincinnati Reds, I didn't know this, they've never had a Cy Young Award winner in their history. Right. Jack says, yeah, and you know, and they've only played baseball for 100 years. Jack, the Reds have been around since 1862. Not only that, the Cy Young never existed till when the 50s, and they only had one winner for all those years until they finally decided one for each league.
Weren't they the original team in 1869? Weren't they the original team, the 1869, the Cincinnati?
Yeah, that may have been another form of the Cincinnati club, but they go back. Yeah. I should say this. I think in 1882, they were charter members of the American League, believe it or not, whatever form that took in 1882.
Yeah, and over the period of time in Major League Baseball, every team's had at least two, three, four different names of their team. You know, everybody just.
Except for one. Always, same, Danny, who? Same nickname, same team. The only one, same city.
Yankees, no.
Detroit Tigers.
Oh, yeah, really? That's right. The Yankees Detroit be the Tigers. Highlanders and stuff like
sure
that.
Sure they were.
You know, so this is all happening with empty stands, and I complained about it last time. I know we got some mailbag on it where I just think it's obscene. It just looks terrible. It's colorless. But you know what? It's actually worse than empty stands. You know why it's worse than empty stands? Because every shot you have at the ballpark, there's some guy with a mask on sitting there not paying attention. He's got to be working there or something. So you see the occasional straggler. You know, it's like when you're at a play and you see somebody behind the curtain who you're not supposed to see. It's like, you know, it's just looks so bush to see just some guy or some girl or some guy with a mask on or a camera not even paying attention to the game is the only person in the stands. It's just
But I'll tell you one thing worse. They got to learn how to play the game. They got to be able to hit the ball and play. They got to play the game in a sense. They're going to have to learn how to bunt. They're going to have to learn how to sacrifice, hit and run, run and hit. These kids can't play the game. I mean, they really can't play the game. And when do they start getting back to the idea of wanting to really play the game well? Listen, they can, when you have two performances like this you had yesterday pitching-wise, not giving up a lot of runs, you got to win one of those games. Somehow you got to win one. And now it's time. We've seen enough of this garbage. I don't mean garbage to imply the players, but we've seen enough garbage baseball. I want to see Mize and I want to see the other kids pitch now.
Well, I'm not blaming you for
environment.
That.
We're not going anywhere with this ball club because we can't score runs to begin with. But if the pitching shows this kind of stuff, then we got to let him pitch. Let him get used to the environment. Honest to God.
Yeah. I'm surprised you've gone this far into the show, Denny, without any kind of comment on your favorite defensive whipping boy, Nick Castellanos, who butchered that fly ball right into a three-run error to tie the game.
I think we're going to get to that in a moment or two. Absolutely.
I'm shocked it took you this long.
You know, they lost 4-3, but the game ended in the seventh inning. I mean, think of it. Lose a game that ends in the there's just no shame. They'll go forward with anything. You know, it's like at this point, who cares what it looks like? Who cares if there's a man on second base in extra innings? Who cares if it's only seven innings? Who cares if there's nobody in the stands? It's like, who cares if we got to cancel games and move them around, make you the home team? The Tigers now in the next four games, they're going to be the home team for two games. And in their ballpark, the Cardinals are going to be the home team for the other two games.
And that that series was supposed to be in St. Louis, wasn't it? And a couple of Cardinals came down with COVID-19. So they said, well, we'll move it to Detroit. I mean, you know, they got to decide, you know, they should have decided a long time ago, and I've made this point before, what they're going to do now, about what they were going to do. Now, Friday morning, just a few hours before the first pitch at Wrigley, MLB suddenly canceled the Cubs game with St. Louis because two Cards players had just tested positive for COVID. Of course, they didn't have any symptoms. Despite all the planning, Major League Baseball obviously did. The people never got to the key issue.
Well, here's the problem.
What are we going to do if players start testing positives? How many positive tests until we cancel large number of games, such as they've now done with the Marlins? They don't expect any of the athletes in the prime of life to die from this, of course, and the vast majority aren't going to have any symptoms. So they should have said, we're going to play on regardless, and we'll bring up minor league kids if we have to take their place temporarily, or we're not going to play at all. They should have done one of the two.
Well, here's the deal.
Brandon wants to say something here.
Go ahead, Brandon.
I just think that maybe Marlins and some Cardinals need to stop going to bars and casinos because that's the issue. You need to follow the protocol, and we're not supposed to have these issues. So far, these baseball players haven't been following the protocol.
Right. And that's what the commissioner said. Either starts adding to the and stopping and playing the game and reporting on time, getting to the ballpark, getting your rest, and abiding by the rules so we can continue and play the rest of the season out. Now, Eli, I got a question. Are you promoting 9 innings or are you promoting 7 innings?
Who wants 9 innings?
I'm just saying, if you're going to do something, they're shameless. So why not be equally shameless and start the game in the third inning so you can at least make it look like
funny. He's being tongue-in-cheek. He wants 9 innings like the rest of us do.
This is a bad analogy, but they're doing anything in desperation to get this season in. Pretty soon they're gonna go to 3 balls and 2 strikes instead of 7 innings.
This isn't a reason to burn it all down. Listen, this is gonna only happen for 1 year. At least, dear God, I hope so. It's gonna happen for 1 year. Let them play with it as they want to play. I think it's a good idea, 7 innings, and I'll tell you why. Because it's saving us 2 more hours of television that we have to watch these guys play. I think it's a wonderful move.
I still kind of enjoy what I'm seeing here. These guys are such great players. And I got a question for you, Denny. I just asked it a moment ago, and then I've got another question about the Tigers have to have. Well, you watch Tyler Alexander.
Yeah.
Is this kid the real deal? His fastball barely breaks glass. What do you think of him?
Well, he's throwing a 90-some mile-an-hour fastball. That's
he's not throwing that hard.
This kid can throw. He's got a real good breaking ball. Now the test will start because he's overwhelmingly impressed everybody. Now the next time he comes around, let's just hope he pitches a pretty good ball game and stays on top of everything and gets them out because he has just driven himself into one of the prime locations in that rotation. He will pitch the next time his turn. Now,
I don't know. Brandon, are they going to use him as a starter? Or are they going to continue to use him in relief?
No
idea.
How
would Brandon know?
No idea.
I don't know either. I don't know. Now I got another question for you, Denny. Yeah. You've been very critical, as our regular listeners know, of Jacoby Jones, who didn't have a good Sunday. I said if the guy hits at all, he's worth it because he's so great defensively. So did you see this? Over the weekend, the Mets picked up Billy Hamilton from the Giants, basically just for defensive center field purposes. And they got a kid pitcher named Jared Hughes, who played with them in Cincinnati. And Hughes says, I had a great year in 2018, and I tell everyone who asked me what happened, the center fielder was the difference. He caught everything. He robbed the homers. Anything that I gave up that was hit hard to the outfield, Billy was there to catch it. Denny McClain, how many times did Mickey Stanley save your butt?
I don't know. By the way, Bob, that's the reason they're out there to catch the ball.
It's an exaggeration.
They throw guys out at second base and third base. And that, it is a complete exaggeration.
Total exaggeration.
Listen, these guys know how to play the game. Most of them know how to play the game real well, with the exception of Castellanos, who they got to get a helmet for him because he's going to get killed out there.
He needs to be moved back to third base.
And I'll give you the... And a lot of people, for the first time, have heard this story today. I walked in a Erie, Pennsylvania one night, and K-Line was there, and he was working with Castellanos. And he said, Bob, can I please speak?
But you've said this many times. Go ahead.
Bob, who cares? Just play with yourself or something while I do something. So anyway, bottom line is, K-Line says, listen, you're not going to believe it. He said, just stand here for about 20 minutes. If this kid doesn't get hurt, it's going to be a miracle. I said, nobody's that bad. He said, oh, Lord, get ready. And Al didn't have a lot of humor, but he was humorous as hell that day. And he started hitting them fly balls. And anything he had to go 10 or 15 feet left or right, he could not catch up with. And when he did, if he caught it, it was like he caught it just in his webbing. And yesterday he had no business chasing that ball down because he has no idea which way to be looking.
He didn't
when the
turn
ball
properly
was hit
on
to
it.
Him. This was a car crash. When I saw him running across, I said, uh-oh, car crash.
I'm surprised.
Okay, Danny, remember this. This kid was a natural shortstop. Tigers moved him away. They moved him to third. And then they made the mistake of putting him in right field. This guy hit two home runs yesterday that gave Cincinnati all its runs in the early going. The Tigers, and I'm not second guessing, I said this. They needed to re-sign that guy and put him back at third base. And what do we got? Keimer Candelario, who starts the season 0-17 instead of Sunday.
I'll remind you that we went to a game together some years ago when Castellanos was playing third base. You and I were sitting along the first baseline, and he let a ball go right through his legs. And you said Brooks Robinson never would have done that. And you asked the girl with the Tiger hat on if she ever heard of Brooks Robinson.
I remember that.
Of course. I remember that. So, listen. Well, the good news for Nick Castellanos is that they're probably going to be the DH in the National League too. So he's a perfect, he's a natural DH.
Well, they'll never have to worry about him winning a Golden Glove. They can get the gold ready for somebody else.
Yeah, and the Tigers got a DH they're paying $30 million to, who can't get around on a fastball anymore. He's sitting a buck something right now and can't run down to first base when he does make contact.
But Mickey,
he's hitting 143. He's 5 for 35 with 10 strikeouts. The Tigers, the team, are hitting 205. By the way, they're 5-5. A sixth of the season is done, fully one-sixth of the season. Right. They would make the playoffs today as one of the seventh or eighth teams in their conference or their division or their league, whatever you want to call it. Who knows anymore? Because they may change the leagues. Who knows? You know, this is to watch baseball thrash around and make it up as they go along, deciding last weekend to make them seven-inning games. This reminds me, sense of decorum. I hope she can't hear. She's in the other room. So my wife is giving birth the first time, and she's and the moment is coming, and they're saying push and push. You know, and she, I looked at her and said, you know, right now all she wants to do is get that big. She doesn't care what she looks like, what she says, whether she's sweaty, whether her hair is messed up. It's just get the damn baby out. I was very proud of her at that moment. This is baseball. Just get the damn baby out. See if we can get through these 60 games. You know, hopefully it won't cancel it. It's just hard to watch. Anyway, hey, we got some people coming back to join us, and I'm very excited to tell you so, including Hoop McInerney Star Lincoln, my go-to dealership for luxury cars, latest leases, I've told you, the new Nautilus SUV, an amazing piece of technology, power and driving comfort. Michigan especially, no one needs to tout Lincoln's long legacy of great cars, but in buying a Lincoln, you want to be treated with respect, have both the buying and the service experience to be unequaled. And with nearly 105 star reviews in July alone, here's a few for Starlink. And woman writes, my entire experience was more than wonderful. Tim Shea, he's a guy in used cars, was the best thing about the experience. Really cares about his clients. Thanks again. Another, my experience with Star Lincoln has been exceptional. Entire team is an example of premier customer service. After three vehicles, now I'm not just the customer, I'm family. And another says, the buying process during this pandemic was very easy and quicker than I anticipated. Make an appointment at 248-354-4900 or buy effortlessly online at starlincoln.com. That's Hoot McInerney's Star Lincoln. And another sign that normalcy may be returning, though not really in the world at large, is a trusted sponsor is also back, and that's the Aldo Eye Center, performing state-of-the-art custom LASIK. And for people 45 plus, like most of you out there, multifocal lens replacement, an amazing surgery that will give you perfect distance, close and far for the rest of your life. No glasses, no contact. Staff is 100% healthy. All the regulations are being followed in a pristinely safe environment. So COVID, that's forced massive changes in our lives. But once again, you can look at changing for the better is your eyesight. So here's a few for you. Carly, just 19, legally blind without contacts, now thrilled to be 20/20. Pain? Dave says, no pain. Getting my teeth clean hurt more. So get a free evaluation. Find out which procedure will change your life in ways you can only imagine. Call 1-800-398-EYES or go to YaldoEyeCenter.com and tell them No Filter Sports sent you. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast.
All right, let me ask you two guys a question. All the Major League Baseball clubs have got a pool of 60 players on their team, right? Period. My question is, if you are going to have a 60-man pool, why are you stopping play? If you've got all these guys sitting in Toledo right now who could still come up to the big leagues and
that's
get
what
some
I asked
experience.
Me. That's just what I said. They should have just started bringing them up from the minor leagues.
That's what they were going to do.
I don't get it. Why? Because they're paying all these guys. Most of them are getting the major league minimum at least. But yep. I don't get it. I just don't get it. Why have a pool of 60 guys? It makes no sense.
I think because when a few people, like with the Cardinals, come down with it, they're required to check the whole team, clean the environment and all that. So I think the way it's being played is that you have to get the facility ready also when somebody tests positive and retest everybody, confine them to hotel rooms. I don't think any of us know, is this, as Bob would imply, is this being overly cautious? Just let them play with the COVID and see what happens. In any case,
I didn't say that, but you put them on what essentially is a 10-day disabled list or whatever they call it with the PC terms they're throwing around nowadays. Put them on the 10-day. That's what you medically have to do. You come out after 10 days, you get another test, you're negative, go back and play. Don't just let them play anyway. But they should have done something about this. They should have planned this. They should have planned this better.
Because right now they seem to be playing a game without rules. The rules are not consistent. Nothing is consistent with the game right now. And I don't know whose fault that is, whether it's the owners or the commissioner, or the number one problem is you just got to have your players better disciplined if they want to play baseball.
And another thing that's impinging on my enjoyment of the game, though, as I say, I am enjoying watching the games. The one thing that's impinging on my enjoyment is the inconsistency of some of the umpiring. Larry Vanover was horrendous in the first game on Sunday. And I mean with a capital H, horrendous. So we're going to have this, computerized strike zones. They're going to be using computers to call strikes. I wish they'd hurry up the technology. We're getting there real quickly.
A couple of two final notes about players. So Lorenzo Cain, probably the most accomplished player, certainly to bow out since the season started, played only five games. And I think this just goes to show how a lot of guys are scared. They're really scared for their families. And then, of course, the lunatic, Yoenis Céspedes, is actually AWOL. The Mets can't find him.
No, they know where he is.
They finally got him now.
They finally found him. He didn't report. He didn't answer. They had to go to the hotel and try it. They finally tracked him down, and he's bowing out as for COVID. But I mean,
No. This has nothing to do with COVID.
It says for COVID related reasons.
I know that CNN had a BS headline among many on CNN. What happened was this guy is concerned about what the Mets are going to pay him. You know, I'm sitting at a bar here in South Florida a few years ago, and I met a real nice guy. He'd been a big insurance executive up in Hartford, Red Sox fan. Tigers had just traded for Céspedes, and this guy says to me, "You are going to hate Céspedes." Céspedes is what I call a double dog. He's a hot dog on the field, and he's a dog generally speaking. Twice in the first nine games of this bastardized season, Céspedes confronted Mets officials concerned about playing time and that he'd be kept out of the lineups to prevent him from reaching lucrative performance bonuses. One of those came on Saturday, the day he was AWOL, when he first talked to manager Luis Rojas and then the GM about his playing status and bonuses. Then he just took off. This guy has a history of bizarre behavior. Now, think about this guy, though, how upset he is about the money. In the summer of 2011, he and six others defected from Cuba on a 23-hour speedboat ride. Remember this? They went to the Dominican Republic, and then they got into the country. A lot of bidding. So he signs going from broke and in poverty in Cuba. He signs in 2012, 4 years, $36 million with the A's. They don't like him. They trade him to the Tigers. 2014, the Red Sox then traded him to the Tigers, and that was in the Rick Porcello deal. 2015, Tigers couldn't stand him either. They traded him to the Mets in the Michael Fulmer trade. Yeah. Then he signed a four-year, $110 million no-trade clause with the New York Mets in 2016. And you remember how this guy...
Listen, you can sum it up, Bob... That's
unbelievable.
You can sum it up one way. Last year, he missed half the season by chasing a wild boar on his ranch and twisting an ankle. That's all you need to hear about.
You need to hear one more thing. So he's really pissed also because he was supposed to make $29.5 million this year, and they reduced his salary after all the stuff with the wild boar and everything else to only $6 million. Now, his prorated pay this year is a miserable starvation.
Bob, enough already. Enough for the story.
Bob, go get a Hollywood producer and make a movie out of this.
Jesus.
Well, if they can make a movie out of you, they can do it with anybody.
Well, nobody's ever approached you for one, have they, Bob?
No, they don't, nor will they. Well, actually, I did get a couple of porn.
Stop. Let's.
They mistook you for somebody else, believe me.
Let's move on to two very upsetting stories. Number one, Jamie Samuelson died yesterday. Yeah, I said, how many? And I made a little list here. And tell me how many you remember, because each one was somebody that I knew well and was shocked. 1991, Shelby Strother, great columnist for the Detroit News, 44 years old, cancer. Vern Plagenhoff, 45 years old, the next year, heart attack, Booth Newspapers. Corky Meineke, Pistons beat writer, cancer, 47 years old, 1997. These are our own media people from this town. Steve Crow, 47, heart disease, 2001. Tom Kowalski, 51, heart attack, 2011, longtime Lions beat writer. How about Drew Sharp in 2016, a heart disease, 56 years old, and now Jamie Samuelson. So unusual, unfortunate, and large number of local media.
Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. You're right. Yeah.
It sure seems to me we've had a lot of local people die in the last couple of years. It's been unbelievable. Yeah. And that's only a touch of the guys that have died. I mean, there's a lot of borderline guys that we know that were around the game for a long time and are no longer here.
I forgot Dave Strader.
Yep.
He died. For a year.
Fred McLeod.
Fred was at least 67. It was still before his time. But yeah, Dave Strader was only 45, I think.
Something. I never met Jamie Samuelson. I was long gone to New York, and I've never really heard him on the air. But I think we had a phone conversation once. Man, people are just Mike Stone and Bob Nowski of the Detroit News. They're saying what a tremendous
guy. Was. Great guy.
Tell us what you guys know about him. Eli, you must have known him pretty well.
I guess I worked with him at the Fan back in the mid-90s. That's when he first came to town, and I had just left television. Just a really fair, decent, bright guy. Went to Northwestern. Great use of the language. He was glib. He wasn't really, an attack dog or anything on the air, but he was just well-spoken. Just a class act all the way. Nice to everybody, just the shot of him and his family with his wife, Christy, and those three kids that was in the paper the other day is just enough to break your heart.
I'll tell you, he was one of the few guys around the country that before we did the first interview I ever did with him, he asked me the question, is there anything you don't want to talk about? Because I don't want to get into an area that you're uncomfortable with. I said, my friend, I have heard every question 100 times. There's nothing you can fool me with. Let it happen.
Yeah.
But so we had a good time for about 20 minutes.
That's just real. What a terrible trend.
This other story that's we're going to talk to Jim Brandstetter later. And, nobody loved Bo or worked closer with Bo for more years than Jim Brandstetter, although he was recruited by Bump Elliott because we were both freshmen in 68. And Bump Elliott was the coach when Jim was a freshman in 69. Then Bo came in and then he started doing, obviously for the Michigan replay and all the other stuff through the years. And Jim is, I'll tell you, I'm going to let him speak. I'm not going to speak for him. He's very upset, not just about all this talk and Doc Anderson, but he's very upset at the way the media has covered it. And I'll give him an example of the Sean Windsor article where they quote this John Doe, the guy who came out with a news conference on Thursday saying that he went to Bo by saying he was assaulted or abused, I'm not sure what the right term is, by Anderson back in the early 80s. And this guy, John Doe, was apparently a radio or TV broadcaster. And Jim and I racked our brains yesterday, could not imagine who it would be, went over every station that ever did Michigan football. And so the point being that Windsor quotes him as if it's fact, it's truth, and didn't go to look at who he is, why we should believe him, and didn't do any vetting on the guy who made the accusation. So this is a very, very tough situation. I know we had Stanley Edwards on last week who said everybody knew. I'm telling you, I don't think Jim Brandstetter knew. He was not assaulted by Anderson, and very, very well, he didn't discuss it.
Well, let Brandy say this. You're giving away
I will. But we'll see what he has to say. I'll tell you, though, the players who were assaulted, and I know several of them. We've quoted them on this show. I can't use their names because they're involved in lawsuits.
You don't have to. You heard what Stanley Edwards said when I asked him if he'd been personally assaulted. There was a long pause, and he finally said, "Next question."
Right, but come on. So I got a call on Friday. from one of the former players who's part of one of the lawsuits. By the way, there's, I believe there's 400 accusers and 50 lawsuits out there now.
Yep.
Some have got multiple people in them, obviously. Some have up to 50 people in them. And this former player called me, and he's part of one of the lawsuits. And he says, you know, I've been sitting here. We all love Bo. And we can't figure out why he would allow this to continue if he knew about it. After all, the player told me, there are dozens of doctors in Ann Arbor. Dozens and dozens. Why would you support a guy who had been fired by the health service and now you're supporting him in the athletic department? So they're all putting their heads together trying to figure out what would keep Bo, why would Bo want to keep this guy on the staff? And the conclusion that some of them have come to, unsubstantiated but a conclusion, is that Anderson is the one who supplied the juice back in the day. Because players were taking performance-enhancing drugs. You know, Lyles Alzado and those guys who took it in the 70s and 80s before it became more refined and companies like Balco were established and all kinds of fringe doctors were supplying the stuff, that maybe because Anderson supplied the juice, Bo protected him.
Okay.
That's totally unsubstantiated.
Leli, you and I were
that's
both
a perfect
in those
answer.
Michigan locker rooms. Tell me anybody in those Michigan locker rooms who obviously had a steroid body, because we've both seen them in NFL locker rooms. I don't remember seeing anybody with a roid body.
Well,
oh,
it depends.
Bob,
please.
Come
now.
On, Bob.
Please now.
What?
Did Alex Rodriguez look like he had a roid body? Did Bobby Higginson look like he had a roid body?
I wasn't
body?
Ever in a locker room with
no,
Do
no,
you
no.
think
did,
it's
did,
different between no. football and baseball and basketball? Do you think it's different? It isn't any different, Bob. Everybody wants to get better and better and better and compete at a different level if they can get that high. I mean, that's what on the surface, that's what it looks like. Somebody was providing products, and right. Bo was going to go along with anything to make his football team better.
By Bob's point is that you didn't see the hugely bulked up, incredible bulks like Tony Mandarich, et cetera. But
right.
players would come back larger. These players have told me they'd come back in the spring and the fall and say, whoa, he's been working out. So it may not have been the Mark McGwire type of stuff because it got more sophisticated by the late 80s and 90s. But in the 70s and 80s, this was going on. And we've known for 40 years that football players have taken performance-enhancing drugs. Mm. They were harder to get. They were more black market, and you needed a doctor. And what did you say about your doctor with the Tigers, Denny?
Right.
Living Good would provide the amphetamines, right?
He would provide you many amphetamines as you wanted. It looked like M&Ms. They had all kinds of different colors and, of course, different kind of antibiotics and different kinds of enhancement drugs. And they would put two or three bowls down almost every night, and a player could go get whatever was his choice of the day. And, you know, in his idea, Dr. Livingood was, listen, just make sure you drink a lot of, to get the full force out of it, you got to drink a lot of caffeine, which really pumped your ass up and made you go out there and play one for the bull, you know.
And by the way, I want to mention, Eli, that Dr. Livingood was a dermatologist.
He was also the team doctor. You may
yes,
not
he
know
was,
that.
But his specialty was dermatology.
Well,
specialty was not. It wasn't dermatology. Not in.
Yes, it was.
Not with the ball club.
Of course not.
Do you think any of us had a dermatology problem?
Eli, I wanted to mention also what I told you over the telephone yesterday. One of the best guys I ever knew or covered at the University of Michigan was the late, what a tragic story, died of cancer so young, offensive center John Vitale. So Vi told me that he would get together, a bunch of the Michigan kids with Michigan State kids, they do that in the offseason, work out together. And Mandarich was very impressed with the Michigan kids. He said, what are you guys taking? And Vi said, are you crazy? We don't take steroids at Michigan. Yeah, he didn't look, Vi never looked like he had a steroid body to me.
They might not even have known what it was, but they were given a regimen, take this, take that, do this, do that. So that's just, listen, I wasn't there either in the locker room, but that's what.
That'll be the day when one sport doesn't do what the other sports are doing. That just doesn't happen, Bob.
In any case, when we get to Brandy, you know, some of the things that are said in the Sean Windsor article that's particularly galling is that that Bo should have gotten more involved. He shouldn't have kicked it up to Don Canham. He should have taken his own initiative on this, showed more concern for the brand, and taking for the gospel that this former broadcaster we can't identify was telling the truth that he did go to Bo. In any case, Bo did the right thing in terms of turning it over to the next higher authority, and saying, put it on Cannon's desk. Now, did he put it on Cannon's desk so Cannon would kill it, which is basically what can happen, which is why they brought it to Joe Paterno. You bring it to Joe Paterno, Paterno kills it. Then as an assistant coach or an underling, you don't have to worry about being responsible because you brought it to the guy in charge. And Bo technically did that, if the story is true, by bringing it to Don Cannon. Okay, enough. We'll talk to Jim Branstetter a little bit later. I want to get into some other stuff.
I got something else on Michigan football. Can we do that now, or do you want me to read a commercial?
Go ahead.
This is really a stunning story that was published in the Free Press over the weekend involving Damon Payne Sr. He recalled that he had always rooted for the Michigan football program. He wanted his son, Damon Jr. Remember we talked about this kid? Five-star tackle from Belleville, Michigan, right outside Ann Arbor, and he just signed with Alabama. So Damon Sr. told Renier Saban of the Free Press, I don't know what happened. I have no idea. If you can dig and investigate and find out why, please let me know. This guy describes himself as a Michigan man, diehard Michigan supporter, and speculation is now that it may have been the Belleville High School coach, Jermaine Crowell, who's developed a bad relationship or vice versa with Jim Harbaugh on the University of Michigan, that may have told the kid, if I were you, I wouldn't go to Michigan. I'd go someplace else. Alabama's a good place for you. I mean, if this is true, and if Harbaugh is starting to lose some of the top high school football coaches in Michigan for whatever reason, or if they're just down on Michigan, man, you got to suck up to these guys. You got to play ball with these high school coaches if you want to get the top players. And this apparently is how they lost Damon Payne to Alabama.
And you know, I'll tell you this, Bob, it's really obvious what happens here. If you want to go to Alabama and some of the other schools that these guys are choosing to go to, there's one reason. They're going to be showcased. As long as they're healthy, they're going to be showcased in a better way. You know, Michigan.
That's true.
To me, Michigan's always been the kind of school that is a team thing. Everybody's a part of the team. Win one for the Gipper. At some of these other schools, they're not so much because they promote these quarterbacks all the time and some of the running backs. Bottom line, if you're going to showcase me, coach, I'm coming to Alabama.
Look, there's Alabama, Clemson, Georgia, and Ohio State. A kid knows if I go there, I can be a pro after my freshman year. Or maybe you got to stay through your sophomore year. It's a stepping stone to the pros. Okay, Bob, why don't you do a couple of spots here?
And then we'll want to tell you all about, especially for those of you who are concerned about the environment, and I know you are, we all should be, want you to look into Power Home Solar. It's based in Detroit, and it's America's fastest growing solar energy company. All of Power Home Solar's state-of-the-art panels are made in America, too. Now, with solar energy, you know this. You're going to save money. You're going to help save the environment and also help yourself avoid those costly and infuriating power outages. It's because Power Home Solar has partnered with Generac. They're the nation's largest provider of in-home backup battery and generator systems with Power Home Solar's panels and Generac. You're going to be protected by a single, safe, sustainable solution for energy at your house. Yeah, lower your energy bills and eliminate power outages. Owners Jason Waller and PHS have got financing starting at just $99 a month. You call them at 1-800-POWER-90. You'll save an additional $1,800. So please support them and all our sponsors, including Feldman Automotive. Really appreciate those guys. You know that they're Michigan's number one Chevy dealer. They got five locations, Novi, New Hudson, Lansing, Livonia, and Highland. Feldman Automotive also claims Michigan's number one pre-owned status with its 1-800 pre-owned supercenter in Waterford. You buy a fully inspected and guaranteed pre-owned auto from Feldman, and then you relax because you've got to drive it for 3 days, love it, or bring it back guaranteed. Goal is to make it a can't-lose proposition for all you folks out there. And Feldman assures that with its exclusive guaranteed credit approval. So visit any of Feldman's other 9 locations as well. They've got Feldman Hyundai in New Hudson, Feldman Kia in Novi, Feldman's Dodge, Jeep, and Ram in Woodhaven. We are confident that you're going to find what you need and what you want at one of Feldman's many dealerships. Let them earn your business and at the same time support us here at No Filter Sports. You can also buy online at FeldmanAuto.com, hassle-free at home or in the showroom. You're listening to No Filter Sports Podcast.
Matt Stafford, anybody have a comment on that? COVID?
I still can't believe that they haven't protected him better, or he hasn't protected himself better. I think that's one of the great long shots of all time. You got your best player on the team, and somehow or other it leaks in the closet, and he winds up with this, if in fact he has.
Well, he could have just been near somebody.
Yeah, but
I guess that's protecting yourself. Yeah,
but you got to be better than that, don't you, if you're the number one guy?
It's surprising. Don't know how it could have happened, especially if others aren't involved with him, who he may have been working with as teammates. I don't know, but you can't jump to conclusions and say that he was irresponsible. I tend to doubt that he was, but man, he's got to be careful. His wife has just recovered from cancer. He's got four kids. This is what's scary. And a seventh Patriot, Marquise Lee, has opted out of the season. Philadelphia head coach Doug Peterson, right after saying that their bubble seems to be absolutely perfect, I feel extremely safe, this is a great environment for our players to succeed in, and he comes down with it. He tested positive.
I believe. Okay, so this is the same situation as we have in baseball. Now, we have, as we record this on Monday morning, more than 30 players around the NFL have opted out of playing this year. Many of them have concerns about their families. They have somebody with a debilitating disease at home or whatever. But how many more until the NFL says, well, we're going to cancel the season? Or do they just go ahead and put them in 10-day?
Well, understand.
It's the same thing. What are they going to do?
Well, 30 is just one per team. So right now it's under control. Of course, they haven't started traveling yet, and they haven't had serious workouts yet. But it's only 30 is only one per team.
It's still 30 people, though.
Well, yeah. They also,
more than baseball, right?
By the way, as of 10 o'clock this morning, there's 43 that have now opted out, and the Patriots.
Oh, 43.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 43. And the Patriots have got 8 guys that have opted out.
Another three, one, okay.
Three of them are starters. I mean, you start losing starters, you're in trouble.
Talk about a fluid situation. And now we're just talking pro sports. I don't want to spend too much time on it because we're getting close to talking to Brandy pretty soon. But 13 Pac-12 players have opted out yesterday, and hundreds wrote a letter to the Players Tribune threatening that they are going to with a hashtag We Are United, to say that, hey, there's not a transparency about health risks, no uniformity to ensure we're all safe. We talked about that with Chris Hinton in Michigan, that Real Sports segment that was outstanding, and that the NCAA, according to these players, has failed us, doesn't enforce any health and safety standards. We believe a football season under these conditions would be reckless and put us at needless risk. We will not play until there's real change that's acceptable to us. Of course, they're demanding other things also, like 50% of each sports conference revenue to be evenly distributed amongst the athletes. That's a reasonable request, considering what we all said about them not being paid. But their point is, the NCAA doesn't mean anything anyway. We operate in our own world here. Who cares what everybody else does? We want some of the dough. So the athletes, there's a sense of empowerment in America now, from Black Lives Matter to the various protests going on.
I'm glad you're in our country again.
But.
Yeah, you segue it nicely into what I was going to say. The NHL playoffs opened on Saturday. The NBA season actually opened last Thursday night after we had recorded this show. So Friday night, I decided to record the season opener between the Bucks and the Celtics. That's a pretty good matchup, right? It started with a huge Black Lives Matter presentation, which I got to confess, boys, turned me off so much, I didn't even watch the game. Hey, what they're doing in the NBA, it's like, don't they realize how many people they're alienating with this? As Danny said, all lives matter.
Well, of course, listen, here we go again. Of course, all lives. Do people?
Of course, Black Lives Matter.
Hold on.
Of course, Black Lives Matter.
Do people look at Black Lives Matter and think that they're saying Black Lives Matter more than all other lives? Of course not. Black Lives Matter as much. Black Lives Matter also. That's what the whole thing should be. And so that's why when you say all lives matter, of course that's true, but it goes in conflict to what the alleged goals of this.
Did you guys watch the NBA game? You okay with all that then?
Listen, if that's what they choose to do, go ahead. It's okay with me.
You're okay. Did you watch the games? Did you think it was over the top?
I watched part of it. I'm in and out with
I thought it was over the top, way over the top.
But it was just the first game. It was just the first game.
Yeah.
So it's not going to continue.
And it was the beginning of the game. I mean, that was over with. How many people remembered it by the second quarter? Not very many.
The bigger story, I think, with the NBA is that the bubble works. Whereas baseball, the bubble, there is no bubble. And football's got no chance with no bubble. Soccer proves it. National Women's Soccer League had a virus-free month-long tournament inside a bubble in Utah. The MLS had one in a bubble, in the same bubble that the NBA is in, down in Florida. And it works. Of course, it requires vigilance. It requires a lot of testing. It requires people to be away from their families. It's very taxing, emotionally taxing on players who can't return home for weeks or months at a time. But
And that's what I don't understand about all of this. Why didn't Major League Baseball do this too? Because the bubble
does
work.
They talked about it.
The NBA, is spending $1.55 billion to keep this bubble going through the entire season, through the rest of the year. And Major League Baseball didn't want to consider it because of the cost. Well, yeah, Brandon.
Well, here's my question. I mean, is there a city that has a major league, you know, park parameters, you know, multiple stadiums and stuff like that? Or would they do the NHL's route where there's only two cities and you basically play back to back to back to back to back to back? How could you do that? I don't know of any, you know, areas that have multiple stadiums that could house an MLB.
They were talking about that initially, Brandon. They were going to do that in Arizona. Right. Of course, Arizona is now one of the hot spots. It wasn't at the time when they were discussing this, but there's many spring training facilities down there that could be cordoned off, cleaned up. Players could stay at nearby hotels, and they could have done a bubble, which they discussed doing it down there then. Of course, to play baseball in Arizona in August and September might be a really difficult.
Yeah, but there's no consideration for the fans that show up at the ballpark. So you could play in one city, two cities, four cities, and have everybody there and just let them play from morning up to the sundown to the moon down.
Here's what we're going to do. I'm making an executive decision here. We're going to do this day in sports now. We're going to take a little final break after this. Then we're going to talk. Maybe we'll have time for the mailbag or bring on Jim Brandt.
Maybe we'll have time for the mailbag. People are already treating me. They're pissed off at you. And
that's
your
uptightness
about the mailbag.
Put it this way.
Danny loves the mailbag.
When another million people get pissed off at me, we'll be almost equal at that time.
So we're going to do Brandy. We're going to do Brandy here in 15 minutes by my calculations. So
yeah, hear that.
Do your This Day in Sports. I'll do the mailbag. Then we'll do Brandy. And I got more stuff I want to talk about on this show, too.
Well, you should have got your stuff in when you had your chance. By the way, it wasn't included on my list, but yesterday, August 2nd, 40 years ago, you were there, Bob. Tommy Hearns knocked out Pepino Cuevas in the second round at Cobo Arena, and boxing in Detroit went through the roof and the world. It made Emanuel Steward and Tommy Hearns the two prime figures in the sport briefly. Of course, then Hearns went on to fight Duran and Hagler and everybody else. But this was quite a day, and I remember it 40 years ago yesterday.
I do too. And here's one of the things I remember about that. I'm sitting at ringside. You're sitting in another part of ringside. I'm sitting next to some kind of heavyset Latino guy. I don't know the guy from Adam.
You told the story.
And you come over and say, Bobby, you know who that is? I said, no. You said, that's Jose Torres. I said, yeah. Tell him you were at Yankee Stadium the night he knocked out so-and-so. And just during this fight, this guy was squealing. Eli, squealing.
He was excited.
Hearns is just punishing this poor Mexican kid. And Jose, oh, he's hurting him. Oh, he's hurting him. Oh, my God, he's squealing. And I turned and said, yeah, he's hurting him. He is hurting him. I don't get the whole mentality.
He wasn't squealing. I'm sorry. Squeamishly, he just was excited to see the power of Hearns unleashed on a guy who was supposed to be a devastating fighter and a champion who was turned into mincemeat by Tommy Hearns that afternoon. Mm-hmm. Chicago jury acquitted 8 Chicago White Sox accused in the Black Sox scandal. The next day, Kennesaw Mountain Landis banned them all from baseball for life after they were acquitted by the jury. Now, this shows how tough it is in sports, okay? This day in 1990, Yankees rookie first baseman Kevin Moss hit his 10th homer in just 77 at-bats, a record. And guess what? He was gone 5 years later with a total of 65 homers. Tough to make it in this sport.
You know, I covered Kevin, and I knew him. I was in the Kingdom one night where he might hit a ball that would have gone way out of Tiger Stadium. Nicest kid in the world, beautiful swing. He didn't make it, as you say.
Jesse Owens won the 100-meter dash in front of Adolf Hitler, the most famous 100-yard dash of all time back in 1936. And for the first time and only time in Major League history, on this day in 1960, August 3rd, the Tigers traded Jimmy Dykes, the manager, to Cleveland.
Joe Gordon.
Their manager, Joe Gordon.
Yeah.
This day in 84, Mary Lou Retton scored a 10 for her final vault, first American woman to win an Olympic gymnastics medal. Jack Morris on this day in 87 tied an American record 5 wild pitches in a 4-2 loss to the Royals. Joe Negro on this day in 87 was found with a file in his back pocket. You all remember that. And this is the last one. This day in 1967, the Chicago All-Star game, remember the NFL champ would play the All-Stars. Green Bay beat them. They 27-0. They ended this stupid series 10 years later in 1976. Do you remember this game? Steelers leading 24-0 over the college All-Stars. It starts to rain torrentially. Eric Parsegian calls for time. Fans invade the field, begin sliding in the turf. Heavy security can't get them off. They cancel the game. Fights break out on the field. And finally, the NFL said, enough of this nonsense. That was the end of the college All-Star game. And
I love that game, by the way, as Brandon says, it's time to go to something over here.
We got to say goodbye to WCWA in Toledo. Thanks for listening. You have been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Hey, the coronavirus has changed our world. What hasn't changed is the opportunity to make smart financial decisions. And you know how you do that? You call David Hall Mortgage and refinance your home. You've heard David for more than 3 decades in our community. He and his team have maintained leadership in this mortgage market. They consistently offer better options, more personal attention that gives rise to lower mortgage payments and the most satisfied clients. And if you refinance now, you can probably skip up to a couple of payments. They've sustained their leadership by providing the fastest service in the business also. Generally, 3 weeks are left. Less. That's why they've garnered nearly 1,500 five-star reviews from Michigan homeowners. So go to davidhallmortgage.com or just call 248-308-5000. Hall Financial. Lower payments, better options, more personalized attention. And, of course, a reminder to call Luke Nowacki. Pinnacle Wealth Strategies support Luke, a highly ethical and well-regarded expert in financial planning, whether it's planning for future obligations, weddings, college funding, whatever, retirement. Call Luke. Let him develop a comprehensive plan. He's got decades of experience creating custom solutions for businesses and individuals like you. Call him at 248-663-4748. You get a complimentary consultation. Fire away with all your questions and lay out a plan for you that fits your needs. Again, Pinnacle Wealth Strategies, Luke Nowacki. Call 248-663-4748. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. All righty. You got a few minutes for the mailbag? Knock it out.
We got a relatively short mailbag today. And, of course, we're going to lead off with comments about the last guest we had, John Mengel, the longtime Detroit Piston and NBA guard. Now, Denny, I don't think you know Kurt, Dave, and I know Eli does.
No.
Kurt's a motivational speaker, writer in the Detroit area, hosts a TV show there. Great guy. 6'9". He played 4 years at Saginaw Valley. And he played a little pro ball in Germany. So he's a big fan of the show. Love the Mengel interview. And he says, true story. I was attending the Dave Bing basketball camp hosted at Alma College when I was in 8th grade. I was playing with the counselors, players in the evening, and John Mengel was guarding me. I caught the ball in the post, and before I could make a move, my shorts were down at my ankles, pulled down by Mengel. Needless to say, I dropped the ball, and Mengel proceeded to waltz down to the other end of the court and score a layup. Paul Caron, another great friend of the show, says, interesting interview with Crash. I always have questions after your show. In Mengel's case, what was it like playing with Marvin Barnes? What was it like playing under Herb Brown? Was he in the locker room, and did he witness the night Kevin Porter jumped on Herb's back during a fight? And could he smell weed on the floor at Cobo Arena just wafting around back in those days? You know, these are great questions. We can't ask guests everything we'd like to in the 30 to 40 minutes we have for them. So I wrote Mengel and asked if he would respond to Paul's question so I could read them right here in the mailbag.
Can I interrupt a little bit? Can I interrupt for a second?
He
never played with Marvin Barnes. I looked at him. I was going
to
ask him.
That's why I wanted to ask
him. Barnes joined the next year.
Okay.
Because Bang got left after 76 and Barnes was 76, 77.
Yeah. So John says he's going to write Paul Caron personally. I don't know if he has yet. Paul Hibbard tweeted, and just what I was talking about a moment ago, and I don't think you guys are looking at this properly. Paul Hibbard wonders, how are major sports going to walk back this Black Lives Matter stance when ratings and attendance drop off the cliff? Of course, attendance is not a big deal, not now, of course. But, I mean, I wonder what the ratings are going to be on these NBA games. I mean, a lot of people are pissed. Brandon says up, 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 and away. Good.
Yeah, okay, we'll I think so, too.
I don't think enough people are pissed because the majority of America is for it. 70% of America supports the movement. So,
yep, they sure do.
You guys can tweet any of the three of us at Eli Zaret, at MU2Denny, at Bob Page Sports, Bob Page Sports. You can also send us an email, asknofilter@gmail.com. And here's David Jones, who's been with us before, saying, I'm seriously confused as to why Eli keeps bringing up the fact that baseball games and previously golf have no fans in such an exasperated way that it makes me think it's impossible for him to understand how any of us could enjoy watching a game with no fans. Is there more value in the bleachers than there is on the field? I've watched as much golf and baseball as I could since they started playing again. And while no fans was certainly a change, it was just a reality I got used to, made absolutely zero impact on my enjoyment of watching the game. On the other hand, this from friend of the show, Al Kopak, who says, Eli is right. Baseball is a spectator sport. As much of a baseball fan that I am, I just can't watch it.
Listen, fans belong in the stands in baseball. Period. And the reason I have enjoyed golf just as much, that's true in the 18th hole, the guy comes through in the hole, the tournament's nice to everybody applaud him. But the problem is in golf, the fans are on the field. They're on the damn field and they get in the way. They're on the actual playing field. Even in the NBA, they're restricted to the sidelines. You can't walk on the court. In baseball, you can't go on the field. So golf is BS anyway, where they allow fans. So I enjoy golf more, I think, with no fans. Yeah. I can hear what the players are saying to each other.
But there's a reason you enjoy golf more, because you play. It's got a personal effect. I mean, that's the reason why you like golf so much. You can't play baseball. You can't play football. You can't play tennis. You can't play any of the other sports.
You're right.
You can golf.
Right. And in golf, I can say, you know what? I had 143 yard shot today. Of course, I'm hitting an 8-iron. He's hitting a wedge. I see what he's doing. I look at his swing, and I'm just saying. And I can stand right next to my 70-inch Sony monitor, like I'm standing right behind him. It's the greatest thing. But yes,
and of course, the PGA Championship starts on Thursday. Yeah, and on our next show, our two resident golf experts going to have a lot to say about that. Al also had a couple questions for you, Denny. First of all, can you explain the difference in ball movement between an overhand pitcher and a sidearm pitcher? Is it harder to control? I've heard that it's easier on the arm. If this is the case, why aren't more guys using it?
I don't know which he's talking about being easier. It's easier.
Sidearm.
Okay. No, not sidearm. Underarm. I'm not talking about softball either. Underhand. I'm talking about the way Joe Fall?
But they
throw the fastball underneath.
Yeah.
And that's
Quisenberry did that.
Way to pitch. Very difficult way to pitch. On top of that, you're not going to be in a position to field the ball coming back at you. You're going to take a couple in the coconut. And as far as the overhand guys, most of the overhand guys wind up having really good control. Remember this, the overhand fastball guys, the ball takes off. If you can throw the ball with enough velocity and get the seams in the right place, the ball will take off, period. And that's the best pitch in baseball, throwing that high fastball that everybody wants to chase.
Didn't you drop down once in a while, as I recall you did once in a while?
Yeah, I did. I did once in a while. Yeah, mm-hmm. I tried. And most of the time, it wasn't totally successful.
Right. And the other one, by the way, is that you've been saying pitchers are far ahead of the batters early in the season. But then, Denny, you said at the start of the show Thursday that the pitchers are still getting their rhythm. Which one is it?
Well, you know what? During a normal spring training, the hitters would be way ahead of the hitters. This is not a normal spring training. They have not had the competition that they needed to be intense enough to start the season. So they're probably equal about right now, except our club, because our club is just afraid to put the kids in that should be playing.
Jeez. You want to say thank you to listener Ryan Epstein for sending along a shot of those digitized fans in the stands. This was from the Yankees Red Sox game. Did you guys see that picture? Very weird. I mean, is that what they're doing?
Or is that
some ball games they are? Oh, we talked about that last show. Fox has been doing some of that. I still haven't seen it.
There's no shame in any of this. It's a shameless attempt to play baseball. Go ahead.
Yeah, and then I'm going to close this out, Eli. I think I might do one more, depending on how much time we have. And to remind you folks, you can call us anytime you want. Text us, leave a message at 760 8-9 balls. Cheryl from Rockwood, we love her. She's one of our few women listeners, I think, and she comes through with a question for us every now and then. So she says, Dan Dickerson and Jim Price on the radio have been talking about the balls being juiced, and that's why so many people are hitting all these home runs right now. Denny and Eli, what do you think?
Well, Brandon? I don't think neither one of those guys would be the experts I would go to find out if a ball was juiced. I can tell you that.
Well, Walter has been carrying at Comerica from all the games I've seen, which is all of them.
Listen, when you throw the ball down the middle at the belt, people are going to hit home runs. It's that simple. This is the worst pitching I've seen in a long time. I really mean it.
Did you watch that home run that Jonathan Scope hit last week? Totally fooled by a curveball way out in front of it, and he still knocked it out over the left center field wall. I thought, what the hell's going on out here?
If a guy knows how to adjust to an off-speed pitch by keeping his bat back, that's a talent you have to learn. That's a K-line thing. If you can go out there and look for a fastball, and all of a sudden they throw you a changeup and your bat is still back, you can still drive the ball pretty far. Just ask L. Kaline.
Let's talk to Brandy.
Absolutely.
Well, 2003 marked the 100th meeting of Michigan and Ohio State. Dozens of former Michigan stars were on hand, along with 112,000 fans at Michigan Stadium. And as he had for decades, radio color commentator Jim Branstetter both set the tone and voiced his passion and expertise for Michigan football and the Wolverines' 35-21 victory.
This is great to be a part of and watch. We wish everybody in our listening audience could get a load of this. It's just the emotion. You can feel it. The intensity, you can cut it with a knife. It's all here in this stadium with this Michigan football team running out in between all of the great Michigan football players, all in their letter jackets from the time when they played. What a great moment, and what a great way to start this great classic rivalry out in the year 2003. I'll tell you this, Chris Perry made a cut as he got through the line of scrimmage. Great block by Dudley, but then the cut to Bet Sally again, and a great block by Tyrese Butler in the end zone got Chris in to score.
I hate to say more ways than one, those were the days, but yes, they were, and Jim Branstetter joins us now. And Jimmy, man, with college football on the brink, you listen to stuff like that back when we were beating Ohio State. What does it make you think?
I'm sad that we may not have a season. I don't know. This COVID thing has gotten in the way of a lot of stuff. I think back to that, and I think about the emotion of the game. And, you know, back when we were beating Ohio State, that was just great stuff. And I, like I said, this will be the first year in 60 years that I have not been in a football stadium in the fall if we don't play.
Sure.
Whether it's broadcasting or playing, and just – man, it's tough for me to figure it out. I wish I were back in there getting ready for the season.
Jim, out of all the teams in this market, MSU, Michigan, the Tigers, the Lions, and all the other teams that we have in this, which is going to be the first one to crash and burn? Because they're not all going to make it.
What do you mean by that?
Probably, I just think probably college football is the most difficult thing to navigate through the COVID-19 viruses. So I think the Big Ten, and within a couple of days, will probably make a decision on that. So I think college football, whether it's Michigan or Michigan State, I think the conference is going to decide that. But after that, I think that you got to look at the NFL. I mean, there are guys. I mean, New England can't hardly field a team right now because there are guys who won't play because of the COVID virus. So I think the football situation is really problematic going forward with the given how the game is played and the rules about social distancing and how medical professionals are talking about contact.
Brandy, yeah. The highest holy day of the year on the sports calendar for many people, and for you, of course, is Michigan-Ohio State. But for a lot of us, it's Michigan versus Michigan State. Can you imagine those games looking like nothing more than a controlled scrimmage?
No
fans in the stands. It's going to be – I don't even want to watch.
Well, Bob, is what the bite that they led into this podcast with, of me talking about the emotion in the stadium.
Right.
If there are no fans there, Bob, you're absolutely right. You're 100% on. Mm. If there are no fans there, there's no emotion. The players can have all that emotion. But what do they say? Denny, you know this having played.
Yeah.
You feed off the emotions of those people that are there. If they're not there,
to me, it's hollow. It's empty.
And think about this. Think about the buzz, Brandy. The buzz outside Michigan Stadium before the Ohio State game. The buzz all the way. Right. The buzz in the stands. It's unbelievable, the intensity, and now nothing.
Absolutely, and that's not the way you're supposed to play the game. And I don't think the game would be well served in that regard. And the tailgates, everything leading up to it, creates that moment when you play the game. And as Bo used to say, toe meets leather at 1 o'clock, boys.
You know, with 100,000 seats, they could, with social distancing, still get 20,000 people in there. I don't know whether that can happen or not, but, you know, especially Michigan Stadium, it's of all the stadiums in the world, just about to be empty is just, it's just too much to even imagine.
And Eli, to your point, 20,000 would be empty. I mean, you could put 20,000 in there, and if you look at 20,000 people in that place, it's still empty. I mean, it would look empty. It would.
It's Eastern Michigan versus Ball State down the road. That's what it is.
Eastern Michigan Ball.
You know, I want to get into we're going to get into the whole controversy with Doc Anderson and all that later and everything. But I want to go back to some of the roots here. And by the way, was I right? I said, and I'm not bragging. I said before we were early in the show, it struck me I might have been the first one to hire you to do Michigan football.
That's a fact.
That's crazy. You've been with them so long. You've had so many incredible jobs and such a profile. But yes, it started very humbly. You know, why don't you tell that story?
Well, you were a director for old. What was the guy's name? Ray Rutledge.
It was Ann Arbor Cable. It was Cable Ann Arbor 3.
Cable, before cable, for you guys out there, before cable became cable TV, Ann Arbor tried to wire itself. We had probably, 35 households on cable, Ann Arbor cable. But Ray Rutledge was the director. He wanted to do Michigan football. He got a deal with Canham Dunn where he would do a game, and we would run it on a videotape delay at midnight.
Because you couldn't see Michigan football. You couldn't see it. It was only one game a week on national television, and that was it.
That was it. So to see the game, and so Eli calls me out. He's the director. He's the guy calling camera one, camera two. Says, you want to come down? I'm working in Saginaw at the time.
And this is the smallest station in Michigan, the tiniest station there is.
Channel 25 in Saginaw. And literally, I walk up. I get out of work at 11 o'clock on Friday night after doing the news. I come down. I see Eli at 1 in the morning. I knock on his door, and he comes to the door stark naked. I said, wait a minute. I'm broadcasting the game tomorrow, and you're our director? He goes, yeah. And I went, what a hell of a start to my career, right? But we did a full year like that. And Eli directed me the whole time. Eli did hire me for that first play-by-play job.
Before you took the Saginaw job, any other college or professional team offer you a job?
Are you kidding? It was the smallest station in America.
He turned down the Bears job to take that one.
Wait a minute. A station's a station. Actually, because we all like to hang our cap on something.
Yeah, well, I'll hang my cap on the fact that the New England Patriots did offer me an opportunity to play with them, and I lasted the mini camp in the spring.
Really?
I never made it to the fall camp or preseason football. So actually, I sent out like 15, 16 resumes and tapes of what I'd done in college. And the only one that returned it in a positive way was Channel 25 in Saginaw. And I was the sports director in October of 1972, 8 months after I graduated school.
And by the way, remember how much money you were making that year?
Oh, geez.
I remember the money I was making. Yeah, I was making it was like $90 a week was the salary they gave me. And they gave me $10 a week cash for gas because I had to use my own car to go cover the news in Bay City and any sporting event that I had done that evening. So they gave me $90. I think I was taking home like $75.50 a week.
That's what it was like. When I was at Channel 6 in that era, the first time we ever met, I was making $500 a month gross pay, and I had a wife and a kid. Now, I'm the number two guy at Channel 6, dominant station in the market, Channel 10 and Jackson Lansing nonsense. So the sports director's job comes open down there. I'm a natural. I'm going to get that job. I really hustle it. I never even heard from him. I used to watch it every night, competition, and he had this really cute anchor I used to like. Her name was Robbie Timmons.
Yeah.
And night, Robbie Timmons comes on the air, and she says, I'd like to introduce you to our brand new sports director. Here's Jim Brandstatter. I look at Brandy. They hired that guy instead of me? What? And the first words out of your mouth, Brandy.
Great choice.
We're going to make it a big blue 10. That's the first thing you said, and I thought, oh my God, my career is over. That's it.
Well, and they wanted me to give that, you know, hey, you know how television was back then. It's like bosses were saying, make sure you play up your Michigan thing. So I did that. But you know, I got that job. It was really cool. It's about not how much who you know or what you know. It's about who you know. The news anchor at that time was Carl Cederberg. If you remember Carl
Cederberg. Yeah.
Forever. He was at Channel 2 for a lot of years.
Sure.
And he went over and he was anchoring the news at Channel 10. And I played football at Michigan with his son, John.
Oh.
And John told Carl when Bob Kurtz, God, you remember the name Bob Kurtz?
Bobby's been the Minnesota play-by-play guy in the NHL for 100 years.
He was the sports director at Channel 10.
Oh, sure he was.
Before he got the job at WKAR in East Lansing to do Michigan State hockey. So when he left, Carl got a call from his son, John, who said, hey, I played with a guy who's a sportscaster. He's now up in Saginaw. Carl called me. I sent a resume. Next thing you know, they call me. Next thing you know, I got the job. I'm sitting next to Robbie, and I've been doing that for now.
Whatever happened to her?
By the way, Robbie Timmons, let history say, was the first woman to anchor the evening news in America in 1972 at that little station in Lansing. Isn't that true or not?
That's true. That's true. I mean, a network station in the country locally did not have female anchors. The only thing females did back then was weather.
Yeah.
Okay, so
you think, Eli, I think about what kind of balls this guy had. Can you imagine getting a TV job in Ann Arbor and your first words are, we're going to make it a green and white Channel 10. Guys, in a Lansing, Michigan State market, we're going to make it a big blue 10.
There's a contradiction because his father played at Michigan State. His brother played at Michigan State. Yeah. He grew up at Michigan State. And he wound up at Michigan. Crazy. Yeah.
Nobody ever called me smart or accused me of being smart.
Now I got to tell this story.
Eli, I think everybody knows that story, Brandy, right? Do you need to get into that? You felt that Duffy did not treat your older brother, Art, whom I knew well when he played for Duffy at Michigan State?
That's accurate. Most people know that. And I just...
Yeah, I think so.
I knew that, my three choices in school were University of Wyoming, because Fritz Schirmer was out there. You remember Fritz?
Oh, sure.
And University of Dayton, because my mom wanted me to go to a Catholic school. And the University of Michigan. And when I went and visited Ann Arbor, I just fell in love with the place. And Bump Elliott was a class act.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody that was in my class, everybody actually before that, couldn't say enough good things about Bump.
So now listen, the whole world is dying to learn the answer to this question.
Time out. Can we hold off on that for just 1 second? You're going to ask about Bump. I want to tell one bold story.
Danny talk with poor Danny.
I don't have to be anywhere
because,
on Thursday.
Once we make that turn, once we turn the corner there, it's going to be hard to get back to fun. So let me just say.
Imagine the three of us on one show, Brandy. This is what happens all the time. We're all fighting each other.
Now, Jim Brandstatter was all Big Ten in 71, his senior year. We were there at the same time. And I was a sophomore. You were a sophomore. Or not that I play, this isn't about me. But the point is, you're 19 years old, and I remember this sitting in Michigan Stadium as Missouri came to town and somehow beat Michigan 40-17. Four fumbles, an interception, seven sacks, 11 penalties, and a blocked punt. You're 19 years old, you're a sophomore, you're in practice that week, and somehow you, for some reason, become the target of that blocked punt. Tell that story.
Well, Dan Dierdorf was All-American NFL Hall of Famer. Now, he was the number one strong tackle. I backed him up. Well, he got a hip pointer in the game. So, on Tuesday's practice, after that Missouri debacle, I was running with the punt team. Back then, you didn't have the punt team run out 11 guys. They only could substitute two. So, you got a long snapper and a punter that came in. Everybody else had to stay on the field offensively. So, as a strong tackle, I'm on there, the first team on practice Tuesday. The first thing Bo does, we're going to punt, men. And he goes to the defense, the demonstration squad, and he says to them, I want you guys to go live, and anybody that blocks this punt, I'll give you a milkshake. So we're sitting there, and it's live punt. I mean, we're kicking the ball and running downfield. So I'm in there for Dierdorf with the first team, and I jab out, block my man, do everything right, head downfield, look up, identify where the ball is, head toward the ball. I hear a thump. And it's not a foot on a ball, it's a hand on a ball. And we got one blocked. And it's in practice. And we're in the stadium because the practice field hasn't been built yet from tartan turf. I hear in an empty stadium this bellowing voice of Schembechler going, "You son of a bitch, bitch, bitch!" You know, it's echoing through the stadium, and I turn around and I go, "Oh God, somebody is in big trouble!" And I start rolling back to the huddle line of scrimmage. Well, he is running at a sprint, and he's running right at me. And I turn around and look behind me, and there's nobody there. And about the time he got 3 feet from me, he left his feet. and he put an elbow up under my chin, and he said, "You're the worst tackle in the history of intercollegiate football."
He said that about Rich Stranger and Kurt Becker and a lot of guys.
Now, I know that, but he said it to me when you're – hey, I'm telling you, I'm 19 years old, and he's telling me that they wasted a scholarship on me, get the hell off of my field. I should have never had you on this field in the first place, da-da-da-da-da, and everything. And I am literally hyperventilating in tears, and I'm heading up the tunnel. And I'm thinking, as I'm going up the tunnel, because he kicked me off the team, he said, I'm thinking, what do I tell my mom and dad, man? My scholarship's gone. You know, I am absolutely at a loss. And Jerry Hanlon, God bless him, came up the tunnel and grabbed me about 20 feet up the tunnel and said, "Come on back. We need you to practice." And I said, "Well, he just kicked me out." And he said, "Well, it wasn't your fault." I said, "What?" I said, "You tell him that." He says, "I will after practice."
Well, the whole world
down in practice the whole game, the whole time, and stayed on the team.
The whole world is dying to know that Matt Millen fire Mark Champion or get him fired.
That's where you were going with that.
No.
Oh
my God.
No? Are you sure?
No, I'm positive. That is not a Matt Millen deal. That was a Matt Millen wasn't even. I don't think he was there yet.
Who was the guy that had him fired?
What happened was that Matt was, I think, gone. And what happened was the radio guys ultimately that wanted to make the change. And it was WWJ.
The
guy's name was the general manager at the time was Rich Homber.
Oh God. Oh
and
God.
Wanted to get rid of
I know
both.
Who that is. Oh yeah.
Anyway, no comment.
Well, according to he's Champion.
Now, he's now the general manager of TBS Channel 56. But Mark and I both were gone. I don't want you to remember this, but that year, they got rid of both of us, and wow. I was actually saved by the Lions and worked with Dan Miller for 14 years before WJR.
Yeah, you know, Keith, right. I got a question about this That's same thing right. from a listener named Keith, and he also stated, in addition to the Mark Champion thing, that you got screwed by the Lions, and I think everybody knows that. How do you feel about it now?
Well, you know, it's in our business, you're the exception instead of the rule if you go out on your own terms, and the radio station, in my opinion, was more culpable for my exit from Detroit Lions broadcast than the Lions were. But I do know this, that the first time it happened, the Lions came to my defense and actually saved me, and got me 12 or 14 more years with Miller. But this last time, I couldn't survive the general manager at WJR. His name was Tom O'Brien.
People asked me back as if I would know, and I didn't really know because it happened to you. But to me, it was money. You were making a salary that you earned by being there all those years, by putting the time in, by being respected and liked and doing a good job, and they could save a lot of money. And maybe do their diversity thing a little bit better by bringing in Lomas Brown, who would work for a lot.
Everybody complains about him.
I just think it was a money thing. And as I said to Mark Champion when he was fired from the Lions, don't look at the fact about ability. It's got nothing to do with ability. It's got to do with behind the scenes workings, money, contracts, who knows what. Totally out of your hands. That's why this is a tough business to be in, because decisions are made out of your control and nothing to do with your performance.
The tough part is that it isn't your work product that determines whether right. you stay on the air or stay working or not. And that, to me, is kind of counterintuitive to what we all believe in our work career, is that you get as good as you possibly can and continue to improve, but that doesn't necessarily right. translate to job longevity.
Right.
My favorite Brandy moment, by the way, during the Lions games, I was back in Detroit driving around. I was listening to the postgame show. Noodles Marinelli was on the postgame show. He was head coach. I think that was the 2016 season. And they had just gotten killed by some, I don't know, beat them 50 to nothing or whatever. Brandy's interviewing on the postgame live. And finally, he says, "Well, coach, you know, there must, I know there were some positive things out there. What did you say? I didn't say anything positive. There was nothing positive out there.
Sometimes you throw a softball, it gets hit right in your face. That's right.
It's a softball like a watermelon. And it just
explodes. Well,
some guy, real quick about my career with the Lions and doing post game, a lot of guys came up to me and said, you know, you'd make a great funeral director. And I'd go, why? You go into a funeral parlor after every Lions game and try to get somebody to respond. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe that's not too far from the truth.
Anyway, so let's.
Whatever they paid you all those years working for the FLs, it wasn't enough money, Jim.
Thanks, Bob.
Let's get to the let's get to this disturbing story about Doc Anderson at Michigan. Some 100, I think 400 accusers, 50 lawsuits. And last week with a guy who's known as John Doe, who says he was a former broadcaster that Jim and I were trying to figure out who it is. We can't figure who it is. Claimed he went to Bo, said he'd been assaulted by Doc Anderson. Bo, he reports, was angry, sent him to Don Canham, and Don Canham kind of pushed to the side. So now, in the last week, there seems to be at least one testimony that Bo knew about Doc Anderson. What are your thoughts about all that and the way it's been covered in the media?
I don't like it. Bo, I know him. I've known him. I knew him for 40 years prior to his death. And if something was wrong, something like that, Bo would not have sat on that. I can tell you that unequivocally, as my experience as a man who knows the guy. In regards to the current situation in the media, the writer of the article, I think his name was Sean Windsor. To me, it's like Bo has no advocate. You know, the accused no longer has any rights, especially in the public arena. You can take the word of this guy, John Doe, who said, nearly 40 years ago, this happened. And all of a sudden, his attorney starts taking the reputation of a very, very good man who I felt had the highest character and the highest integrity of anybody that I've ever known, and just trashes it. And to me, that's unfair. And there's no vetting of the source in this regard.
But
automatically, you print it, and automatically, it's true. And to me, that's not fair.
But Jim, one thing, I mean, there's 40 or 50 lawsuits. There's dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of people who are saying that this happened and Bo knew. Is there some way to rationalize in some form that possibly knew and passed it to the right guy and the right guy didn't forward it?
Look, I don't know any of that, Denny. And
yeah.
From what I know right now, only one guy, this one John Doe, has accused Bo. I don't believe any Bo or Canham were brought up as guys that were confronted with this Robert Anderson deal. But the one guy did. There's no question he did, because the lawsuit names him. But from my perspective, I know, you know, Bo too, and all the lawsuits that are out there, I can't imagine that Bo would know this and not stop it. Yeah. I mean, I know the guy, you know, and he did it to different events that happened during, I mean, there were recruiting things that happened during the year, and he would not go down that road of violating those kinds of things. And that was just part of the business at the time. So and this goes well beyond that. So
were you examined by this guy? Was he team physician?
I will tell you this, and I know that to answer Denny's question, I know there's a bunch of guys that are out there that saying their experience with this guy included sexual abuse. I can say unequivocally, and I was examined from it at minimum four times, because you need a physical every year prior to playing football. And I think he got one in the January, February range, because in order to play spring football, you needed another one. And not at one time did I think that I was ever abused. It was always appropriate. It was a physical that I'd gotten very similar to my family doctor at home when I was in high school, to get the letter that I give to my high school coach to allow me to get equipment and play. So my personal experience with Dr. Anderson was nothing less than professional. And I never felt at one point that I was treated inappropriately.
Wow.
Well, others obviously were. and he didn't treat everybody inappropriately. The question that's troubling us all today, besides how terrible this is for the university and how many people can claim that they were abused that may not have been. I mean, how do we know whether this guy, I mean, I could say, hey, I was part of Michigan football to a degree. I covered it and everything. And I could say that I was abused, but, you know, I went to the health service, but I wouldn't because it didn't happen. But how many people can falsely say I was a part of this so they can get more money? How can you prove whether you were or you weren't back then if you had any contact with them at all?
You guys can chime in on this, but I think that's part of the problem is
that absolutely.
There's nobody out there that's alive that can – it's one witness to an event, and that's the only witness that's there. Like, for instance, I can tell you to this – and I think I can say this 99.9%. If Bo were alive today – and this thing had come out, Bo would be saying right now, there's no way this happened. I don't remember this happening, and I don't remember this guy. If he said that, where would we be?
Sure. Well, here's what concerns me, Brandy. Where we're going with this, I had my share of run-ins with Bo at times over the years. We all have. But sure. I love the guy.
You know he was a straight shooter, too.
Better absolutely. Believe it. I almost felt like a former player when I'd go up to his little box press box in Michigan State. Paige, how are you? Come on in. You're looking at the Bo Schembechler football building in Ann Arbor. You're looking at the Don Cannon Natatorium, the University of Michigan swimming pool. This cancel culture stuff, are those names going to be wiped off those facilities?
I certainly hope not. I think that the good, the people that Bo Schembechler and Don Cannon helped over the years clearly are a tremendous amount. And this goes to a Robert Anderson thing. And nobody's accusing Bo or Don Cannon of, quote unquote, condoning this stuff or anything. I mean, they just say the allegations are that they didn't do anything about it, even if they knew it. Well, we don't know for a real fact because we've only got, what do we call it, hearsay evidence or whatever. Now, I'm not saying that these people, again, I don't want to get into this about.
No, we understand.
These people aren't true, or their recollections of what happened to them didn't happen. I don't want to go there because everybody has a different interpretation of what's going on in regards to their own body and their own examination by Doc Anderson. The one thing I do know from a legal perspective, and I found it somewhat laughable, that the attorney of John Doe came out and said something to the effect that we need to get this stuff out so the university can heal. Well, that's crazy to me. They're not. There's a lawsuit filed, and there's what happens ultimately in a lawsuit is compensatory damages.
Right.
And those are money damages.
Yep.
And this attorney, I don't think could care less whether the university heals or not. I think he cares about how much the settlement is.
And one third of it he gets.
Yeah, that would be cynical on my part, but he would have more credibility, in my opinion, if the attorney and his law firm said any compensation we receive from this lawsuit, we will donate fully, 100%, to an organization, a nonprofit, that deals with and aids sexual abuse victims.
I would have more credibility if they
came out and said that. But do you think they will?
But Jim, that's a great idea. But those who have been harmed, those who have been abused, they deserve something more than, you know, thank you very much, I'm going to donate everything to St. Jude's. You know, they do deserve, if they've been abused, they deserve.
No, I don't disagree that. But again, that's a matter of proof, isn't it?
Yeah,
I
mean, right. It absolutely.
And that goes
is.
Through the court systems. And if they get their legit deal, that's fine. But if
they're going to settle, it's just like the Michigan State thing, Brandy, with NASA.
Oh, I know.
How do you prove that? But Michigan State paid out $500 million so far.
Well, but the difference too in that is that Nasser's a lie. Nasser,
yes.
You know, there's a difference there, and Anderson's dead. Nasser was alive. Nasser, that whole thing that's apples and oranges in my judgment, anyway, compared to this thing. If somebody was abused and it goes to court and it is proven under the legal standards that we have in existence today, then they deserve that compensation, whatever the court determines or a jury determines. But I also think that it's disingenuous for, quote unquote, an attorney to be all altruistic and talk about how, you know, they want this thing to be a
Yep.
Healing the university process. To go forward. Let's heal. Yeah. You know what their healing is. It's about a bank account.
Hey, we have so many things to talk about with you. So can we tackle this and just shift gears a little bit? The Michigan-Ohio State game is no longer even a rivalry. Ohio State so dominates Michigan, it's embarrassing. Michigan football's not what it used to be. Harbaugh's under pressure. Your thoughts, Jim Brandstatter.
What are the chances?
What are the chances? Personally, I disagree with the fact that it's not a rivalry. You're a Michigan State guy,
right? Doesn't look like it to me.
You're a Michigan State guy, right?
But I covered Michigan for 100 years. You know
that. I know that. But the point is that there were times when Michigan State didn't have a chance. And during that run, I think Bo was 13-2 against them, right? That still was a rivalry. That's still Michigan State. It's still Michigan-Ohio State. That's still a rivalry.
You had a 31-0 game in the rain at East Lansing. That was no rivalry. It wasn't a rivalry.
Let's not get into the definition of a rivalry, okay?
You were talking about the emotion. Nothing stirs the emotion of the rivalry games than Michigan-Ohio State or Michigan-Michigan State. And to me, that's what makes a rivalry, is that the emotions that it goes beyond just the score. It goes to about a institution, your pride, your standing, who you are. And they give little gold pants to the players at Ohio State when they beat Michigan. They don't give white pants to Ohio State when they beat Indiana.
Okay, well, that's fine, Jimmy, but they can't beat Ohio State.
Time out. Okay, here. Let me rephrase that question, okay? From 2001 through 19 games, Michigan has only won two. The game that we played early when you came on, when that great 100th anniversary game, and then they won again in 2011. The question really is, can Michigan ever break through again this recruiting dominance of Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, and Georgia? Can they compete for these the great athletes? Because Michigan plays Ohio State well for two or three quarters. I think the quality of Ohio State's athletes have been pushing past in the fourth quarter, etc. Can Michigan ever recruit with them again and at some point turn this back around? That's what people want to know, I think.
Well, I think they can, and I think it's all cyclical. I mean, there'll be an Ohio State time where they get a down guy. The difference between these two teams over the last few years, in my opinion, has been quarterback play.
Yeah.
I mean,
speed also. Speed.
Speed. Speed at wide receiver. But hey, don't forget, Bob, it wasn't that long ago that Michigan, even with Wilton Spate at quarterback, had a lead against this team, against Ohio State through the third quarter. Throw an interception for a touchdown, Ohio State wins the game. I'm just saying that it hasn't been this one-sided blowout. The last 2 years, yeah, they scored a hell of a lot of points, and it's been a runaway. But the only thing, and Jim Harbaugh is under pressure, but the only thing Jim Harbaugh hasn't done is beat Ohio State. That's the only thing he hasn't done. He's done everything else that anybody has
Don't
ever
you want done to win
when he got the job.
Maybe? Oh, yeah.
Well, but the thing is, there's Ohio State again. If he wins two of those games against Ohio State, he wins two Big Ten championships and probably gets to one, maybe two, Final Four playoffs. That's just the way I see it. Now, you want to disagree with the fact that, yeah, Ohio State has dominated the rivalry. Can't argue that.
But yeah, well, you know,
rivalry, it is a rivalry, and it will continue to be a rivalry.
Okay, but, you know, Mark D'Antonio went to one Final Four, and Michigan couldn't beat Michigan State all those years, so it's been a little better the last few years for Michigan.
Yeah. Well, you know, listen. Jim's been at Michigan since he was a freshman 52 years ago. You've been broadcasting them ever since. 52 years. Trust me, when we crossed the half century mark, I go, whoa, that is
a
big ass number.
Isn't that his freshman year in grammar school?
No.
Thank you, Danny. Hey, listen, I can tell a story, a personal story. I was on the practice field at Ferry Field.
Oh, my goodness.
As a freshman in 1968. And we had a guy, a little manager over the side, giving us the radio play-by-play, basically.
Oh, my God.
The World Series in 1968. You guys were my team.
God bless you.
Well, no, I love you guys. I'm 18 years old. I loved going to – when I was a kid, used to go with my dad to the games. And, God, you know, Don Wirt and all the other guys. Yeah. Norm Cash was just my favorite. Freehand you, Lowlich. Just it was Mickey Stanley.
Did you play baseball? Did you play any other sports?
Oh yeah, I actually, when I was in high school, got an offer from a Chicago Cubs scout that he wanted
really?
Me. Oh yeah, And I told him that I had signed a signed a letter of intent to play football at Michigan. And he took his card back and says, good luck.
were you a catcher with your size?
Catcher, first baseman, yeah.
Huh. I'll be done.
You know, we talked about you playing there in 1969, that Missouri game. Just so you know, because I think you were a part, and Bo too, where Michigan football changed remarkably in that era, because at that game in 1969, only 64,000 for Missouri, only 50,000 there for Washington, 60,000 for Wisconsin, crowds that by the next year, by 70 or 71, were now at 100,000. So you were there. You saw that stadium fill up. You saw what happened when suddenly Bo Schembechler could beat Ohio State and the world changed for Michigan football, 24-12 in 69.
No question. In my 3 years on the varsity team, I mean, it seems odd now, but in my 3 years, I only played at home before one 100,000 seat crowd every year. My junior year, it was Michigan State, and my senior and sophomore year, it was Ohio State. Every other game we played, there were empty seats. I've got a picture behind me of me shot from the end zone. As you look in the background, There's nobody in the seats. I mean, there's just nobody. Can you see it? Yeah.
Well, yeah, I went to a lot of Michigan games when I was a boy. I know that. And then, Brandy, the 10-10 tie just after that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What
was
that like for you guys?
Well, that one was about the post-apocalyptic athletic directors thing. The 10-10 tie was disappointing for everybody. Everybody thought Michigan outplayed Ohio State, but it was the athletic director's vote that Bo –
To tell the truth, it was Bert Smith from Michigan State against Michigan, and Bo was infuriated, and so was Kahneman. I don't blame him.
He was indeed, because the whole deal was Denny Franklin, remember the quarterback?
Yes, we had him on talking about it. Yeah, he's throwing snowballs.
And the thing is, Denny was ready to go by the time the Rose Bowl was being played. Right, he was ready to go 6 weeks later.
Cleveland Plain Dealer had him throwing snowballs on New Year's Day.
Exactly. Yeah. And the point of that being is, the athletic directors felt the Big Ten have a better chance to win if they send Ohio State instead of Michigan, even though Michigan outplayed Ohio State, and Bo will, to his dying day. Absolutely. It was bitter about that. That was the catalyst, though, guys. Think about the change. The catalyst to get other Big Ten teams to bowl games other than the champion. Because the old antiquated system was you went to one bowl, and it was the Rose Bowl, and if you went 1 year and you won a Big Ten
championship, you couldn't go the next.
And they took the second place team. And that was the catalyst. And Bo, I mean, he went to the stump like a candidate running for office to affect that change. And he did that. And to this day, 9 teams in the Big Ten go to bowl games. And some of them probably aren't deserving. They ought to thank Bo Schembechler for it.
But, you know, the thing about Bo, Brandy, and I'd like to hear you address this. You know, you're talking about what a tough guy, what a mean guy was. He got together with his Monday media luncheons at Weber's in Ann Arbor. He was the funniest, the most charming guy you'd ever want to meet entire life.
What a piece of personality. Yeah.
Sure he was.
What a dichotomy.
Well, you guys who knew him knew that. We would go to dinner with him in a social setting. He could charm women to death. They loved Bo, you know? And you wouldn't expect that from the quote-unquote public image that he had from most of the national media, the gruff, irascible, I think was the name they called him. But you're right, Bob. He could charm the socks off of you. He could tell stories. But Denny, if you just sat down in a bar at the Lindell with him and you guys started telling stories, I'm telling you what, you'd still be there. You'd be there for hours, and Bo would be one of those guys that would be just sharing those stories. He was unbelievable that way.
Well, he'd be proud of you being an advocate in this troubled time for Michigan football. We hope we get to hear you again this year. We hope there are games. I hope there are fans.
Hey, can I a couple more things, Eli, if I could? Just two comments about Brent.
We got to be somewhere Thursday, Bo.
I know that. First of all, it's true that Jim Branstadter and his wife, Robbie Timmons, are the sixth largest landowners in all of North America. All they've been doing is buying up property. And secondly, we've never gotten together. I've had people tell me, you are a hell of a singer. And like St. Patrick's Day is your big deal because you got this beautiful tenor voice or whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, back in the day when I drank adult beverages a lot, I found that my voice got better then. I was back in East Lansing. I was an L singer. I enjoyed singing. I still sit in the car and sing Sinatra songs Tony Bennett songs. I was an old saloon singer, and I love
this. I did it my way.
Absolutely. Mac the Night.
Well, Eli and I sing Jefferson Airplane.
Denny, you and your organ playing.
That's right.
Musician himself. So Denny was very good at that. And Mac the Knife is one of my favorites. I have sung Mac the Knife at more weddings than I should care.
Bobby Darin. Hey, Brandy, great talking to you.
That's
Any keep them pearly
white. Oh, well, let's do karaoke some other time.
Out of sight.
Can you hear my dog barking? Woo! Can you hear my dog barking? He's heard enough. My dog can't take anymore.
I'm shocked you didn't go, hail to the victors.
All right, there you go. Hail to the conquering heroes. Hail to Michigan, the leaders and best.
Okay. I've tried to say goodbye four times, so I give up.
Well, we should have Randy on for another hour. We're people got nothing to do. There's nothing to do anyway. He's
stressing.
I'm like, Jim, I'm sitting in my basement watching the stock market, hoping my retirement money goes good.
Yeah, you're not going to starve, Brandy.
Jimmy, don't one worry. Last question. You don't have an adult beverage. Jimmy, you don't have any adult beverages under your desk there, do you?
No, I don't. I got them about 25 feet above me. I got some wine. Okay. And some Coors Light is my beer of choice these days.
This is fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, talk really to you later, Brandy. It.
Take care, buddy.
You too, Bob. Okay. Be well, okay? Bye-bye. Eli.
Tell everybody we said hello.
I will. Thank you
stay
so
safe.
Much.
Stay safe. Stay safe.
Bye-bye. I got another story. Real quickly, I know we're about out of time, that I want to mention. First of all, there was a big story that came out of East Lansing on Sunday, and that is when Xavier Tillman announced that he was indeed going to leave for the NBA. Mm-hmm. This is a big blow to Tom Izzo, because he had really hoped this guy would stay. I mean, I don't know what his NBA skill is, but like Draymond, he plays hard, plays D and rebounds, so he could make it. And did you guys see? I mean, it's not like Tom's crying. He recruited the number one player in all of Canada last week. The 6'10 kid they brought in, Enoch Boakye. Michigan State, if they don't win a national championship in the next 2 years, it's going to be shocking.
Maybe so. All right. Well, thank you all for joining us today. We'll see you again on Thursday for another edition of No Filter Sports.
Thanks, everybody. Stay safe.